In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. I want to congratulate you all on the feast of St. Juliana of Lazarevo, especially the ladies in the sisterhood, because she's the patroness of the sisterhood of this parish. In the sayings of the Desert Fathers, there's one saying about St. Macarius the Great, and he prayed that God would reveal to him who was the holiest person at that time. And God revealed to him that it was two sisters who were living in the world and were married. And he went and he met them and talked to them and inquired about their life, and they lived just a very simple, pious life. They fasted, but they nevertheless didn't have anything extraordinary about the manner of their life in terms of having husbands or trying to live a family life. And the important point that story tells us is that it's not just the monastics that have the capacity to attain to great sanctity. And we see that especially in the case of St. Juliana. She was born in 1530, approximately, in Moscow during the time of Tsar Ivan the Terrible. And her mother died when she was six. So she went to live with her grandmother, who was in Murom. Murom is about as far from Moscow as Houston is from San Antonio, to give you some idea of how far away that is. After six more years, her grandmother also died. And then she went to go live with her mother's sister, who already had eight daughters and one son. And you can imagine an orphan child coming into a family of that size, particularly with eight other daughters, that it was a difficult situation for her. She was often mocked and mistreated by her cousins and even at times by her aunt. And they often ridiculed her because she was a very pious young lady. She fasted often. And she, in this situation, learned to be very humble and obedient. But there was one area where you could say that she had a strong will that she wouldn't be flexible on, and that was when it came to her faith and her piety. And there were times when she would be fasting that her family would try to force her to eat. That's the kind of conflict that she would have over those issues. But in every other respect, she was extremely humble and obedient. She learned embroidery at that time for whatever reason. That was a skill that was confined to the noble class. And she would make embroidered garments, and she would sell them, and she would use the money that she gained to give to the poor. At the age of 16, she was married to George Osorgan, who was a wealthy merchant of Murom. Her life doesn't really say what her thoughts were about this marriage. Probably it wasn't even really that much of her choice, as much as it was a family arrangement that was made. At her wedding, the priest gave a sermon about what marriage meant and how the newlyweds should make their home a little church and raise their children in the fear of the Lord. And this made a very deep impression on St. Juliana, and she strove the rest of her life to live out what she had heard in that sermon. She was not only greatly loved by her husband, but she came to be greatly loved by her mother and father-in-law, and also her sisters-in-law, which is a fairly unusual thing. As those of you that have in-laws know, very often a sister-in-law and a wife don't get along, but they loved her very deeply because she was such a loving person. She became the mistress of the house, but continued to devote herself to prayer, and her husband came to join her in her prayers, and his piety increased because of the piety of his wife. Her husband was a very well-educated man. She never learned how to read. She was a very simple, but a very extremely pious woman. There were many occasions when her husband was called to serve in the army, and there were times when he might be gone for up to 3 years at a stretch. And so during that time, she was left on her own, of course, with her mother and father-in-law as well, to run the home. And so she had great responsibilities. And she ran the home, raised the children. They had many servants that she had to deal with. She continued to do embroidery so that she would have money to give to the poor, and she went to great efforts to do that in secret. so that even her immediate family was not aware for the most part, but she had a servant that she would use to distribute the money that she would raise. She treated her servants with great love and would only allow them to wait on her when they had guests because custom required it. So in the presence of visitors, she would go through the usual motions of allowing them to serve her, but as soon as the guests would leave, she would bow to them and she would say, "Who am I to be served by others who are also created by God?" She was a servant to her servants, and she made sure that they had proper clothes and good food. If her servants quarreled, she would try to mediate between them, and she would often take the blame for the dispute on herself to reconcile them. In 1570, there was a great famine, and St. Juliana, who had the habit of eating only once a day, asked her mother-in-law to send her additional food from her stores, ostensibly so that she could eat three meals a day. Her mother-in-law asked about this and said, up until now, we've always tried to get you to eat more and you wouldn't, but now that there's a shortage of food, why is it that you're eating more? And she said, "Well, I've had children and I have a need for more food." But in reality, she only did this so that she would have more food to give to the starving poor around her. When any poor person in the area would die, she would wash their bodies herself, prepare a burial shroud, and cover the cost of the funeral. After the famine, there was a plague, and many, particularly of the noble class, shut themselves up because they were so fearful of getting this plague. But she went out and she ministered to the poor and prayed for their healing. Not long after this, her mother and her father-in-law passed away, and she distributed alms in their memory, and she continued to do this on the anniversary of their repose every year. She had 10 sons and 3 daughters. 4 of her sons and 2 of her daughters did not survive childhood, but the rest of the children that she had, she raised in piety, and she found great joy in being a mother and raising them. But later she was struck with great sorrow when one of her servants, whom she loved so much, murdered one of her sons. And then, not long after that, one of her sons was killed while serving in the army. She was so struck with grief that she wanted to become a nun. As a matter of fact, all of her life she had really desired to be a nun. And she let her desire be known to her husband, but her husband reminded her of the sermon she'd heard on her wedding day and the admonition of the priest. And then he said, "Black garments will not save us if we do not live monastically, and white garments will not destroy us if we do what is pleasing to God." And what he means by that is black is the color of the monastic, and white in Russian terminology is usually referred to people who are married. "If anyone departs to a monastery not desiring to care for children, he seeks not the love of God, but rather peace. And the children orphaned will often weep and curse their parents, saying, 'Why, having given birth to us, have you left us in tribulation and suffering?' If it is commanded to feed the orphans of others, it follows that one ought not to starve one's own children." And we're told that he, being, as I said, a very educated man, quoted many passages from the fathers and from the scriptures in support of his argument that she ought not leave her family. And she was persuaded, and she simply said, "Let the will of the Lord be done," and she never left. About 10 years later, her husband also reposed, and she did the same thing that she had done when her in-laws had passed away. She gave away a great amount of alms, but now she was the most senior member of the family and was free to give even more without any concern of what anyone else in the family might think, and so she gave away all that was not necessary to maintain their household. Then another far worse famine happened during the reign of Tsar Boris Godunov. It was a very disastrous period. And eventually it got so bad that the family had to actually move to a small village near Nizhny Novgorod where there was still some food available. And eventually it got so bad that she had told her servants to go out and gather up pigweed and to strip bark off of a certain species of elm tree. And she prepared a type of bread to feed herself, her children, and her servants. And through her prayers, the bread that was made from the pigweed and the elm bark turned into a very tasty, sweet bread. And poor from all over the area were coming to her and asking for this bread. And we're told that there were many rich people who had wheat that they were keeping to themselves, and so they were not doing without bread. But when they heard all these people raving about this bread that they were getting from St. Juliana, eventually some of them sent so that they could get some as well, and they acknowledged that it was an incredibly tasty bread. Eventually, she became ill herself. And so during the day, she was confined to her bed. But her servants noted that during the night, she would stand up and she would pray throughout the night. And her servants would say, "What kind of a sick woman is this? During the day, she stays in her bed, but at night, she stands in prayer." And her response was, "Well, sick people are not excused from the need to pray." So that was her answer. She reposed on this day in 1604, 413 years ago, and she instructed her family that she wanted to be buried in Murom next to her husband. And eventually, of course, the family moved back to their land in that area. Years later on, one of her sons reposed, and her coffin was found in the family crypt as they were going through the process of burying her son. And there were some curious women because they saw this coffin. It looked as good as new. And curiosity got the better of them. They weren't sure who was in there. And they opened up the coffin. And they saw St. Juliana. And they found that the coffin was full of myrrh. And they told the family. And they took a vial of that and took it to the cathedral so that they could show it to the church. Many people were healed by that myrrh, and there were many miracles that were even worked by the dirt around the grave. What this tells us is there's no limitations on us to attain to sanctity. There's no difficulties in our life that we might be going through that are really preventing us from living a pious life. We may think that we have it tough, that these days it's so difficult to really be focused on the spiritual life. We've got really hard problems. Those people back then didn't have hard problems. Well, just imagine what it would be like to have people starving around you. During these famines, it got so bad that people were even reduced to cannibalism. That's how bad it got. And yet here we had a woman who, in the midst of all these difficulties, in the midst of great sorrows personally, in the midst of a life where she lost her mother, her grandmother, and in one situation after another, found herself dealing with grief and difficulties, nevertheless devoted herself to God. And so we need to put aside all of our excuses, because I doubt there is a single person in this room that's ever had to deal with anything remotely like what St. Juliana had to deal with. That kind of deprivation, that kind of hardship. So let us turn to her in prayer and ask for her help so that we too can attain to the spiritual life and exercise pure love for God and for our neighbor. Amen.